From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world is watching April, a pregnant giraffe about to give birth in Harpersville, New York. But it's a less joyful picture in Africa, where the giraffes are suffering, in danger of extinction. The population has declined nearly 40% in three decades. Alex Shumatov, a renowned writer and naturalist, recently embedded with giraffes in Uganda. This hour on Point, he tells their story. You can join us on air or online. Are you watching Giraffe Cam? Have you seen giraffes in the wild? Describe that experience. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Harpersville, New York, is Jordan Patch, owner of Animal Adventure Park, where April the giraffe is expecting a calf any day now. Jordan, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Jane.
So how is April doing?
She's doing well. She's progressing just fine, and we're quite happy with the progress thus far.
How far along is she?
Well, we could tell you she's in that 15-month average of pregnancy now. All physical signs and behavioral signs are suggesting we are end of term, so we're just waiting for a calf to appear.
Any minute? Okay. Your giraffe cam has gone viral, as I understand it, around the world and back. Tell us who's watching this.
We have done media outlet requests and received fan mail from just about every corner. We have Australia, Scotland, Ireland, the UK, Germany, Thailand, all across the United States, Canada, and even into South America.
So millions of people are watching this.
Hundreds of millions. I believe the view count is somewhere up, believed to be about a billion.
Oh, my. And watching for hours on end, right? Hours and hours at a time.
Yes, at any given time, we have, I would say, a minimum 30 to 40,000 people watching on our feed alone, with us peaking somewhere up around 120, 130,000 at a time.
So how does April generally spend her days?
Well, it certainly depends on the weather that we're having here in upstate New York. Today is a nice, warmer day for us, so our giraffes are going back outside. However, the weekend brought some very cold and frigid temperatures with ice and snow, which creates a slip-fall hazard in their yard, which limits them to barn access only.
So can visitors at the park see her?
Well, currently we're in our off-season. We're a facility that's open between May to the end of October.
I see.
So right now this is supposed to be our slow time, and it's not very slow.
So whenever this happens, she will give birth standing up. Is that how giraffes give birth?
Yes, that's correct. We definitely want them up on their feet, because once that baby enters that birth canal, we really don't want mom down, because there is a risk for a crushing of the calf in that area.
I actually have some sound of Katie, the giraffe, who gave birth in a live broadcast in April of 2015. That was featured on AnimalPlanet.com. She was 15 months pregnant, and this happened at the Dallas Zoo. This baby calf fell 6 feet to the ground when it came out. Here's that.
Oh, this is very exciting because we've got a lot more calf.
A lot more calf.
And she's pushing. And we've got a giraffe calf. This is so cool.
Will your April be alone when she gives birth, or aided by zookeepers?
We will have a full team on standby. That includes our veterinary team, our lead keepers, and obviously park ownership and management. We'll be there ready to intervene should there be an issue, but we're really going to try to allow April just to naturally birth and have a non-invasive labor.
Do you have a name yet?
We do not have a name. We're gonna have the world join us in that process and suggest names and vote on that.
I also understand people are blogging. They're eyeballing April's abdomen to see if she's having contractions, see if they can catch a glimpse of a little calf moving around in there. What are you seeing, Jordan? What's your view?
Well, we see a lot of natural behavior that people that are afflicted with this giraffe hysteria are turning into contractions and other signs of labor, and it's just not the case yet. The one thing you are going to be able to visibly see from our giraffe cam are our belly movements and kicks from that calf, which are very prevalent to the naked eye. But as for any time the tail raises she stretches out her neck, that being equated to a contraction, we're not there just yet.
Well, I have to say, she is very cute. Captured the attention of our house yesterday. Thank you so much, Jordan, and good luck. And good luck to April.
Great, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Joining me now from Montreal is renowned nature writer Alex Shumatov. He's made his career reporting from remote corners of the world, often sharing the stories of endangered species. He recently followed giraffes in Uganda for the Smithsonian Magazine piece called The Last Giraffe. You can link to our website at onpointradio.org. You can also view the stunning photographs of the animals from Michelle Grew, who traveled with Alex there. Alex, great to have you with us. Thank you.
Hi, Jane.
So that was the good news of the hour, little April giving birth. What you see and what you experience in Africa is not so happy all the time.
Well, where we were, it was very positive because the Rothschild's giraffes in Murchison Falls National Park are flourishing since the Civil War, when they were almost wiped out, as long as the elephants. There's now thought to be about 1,500 of them. That's the largest population in the wild of these Rothschild giraffes, which are some of the tallest and the most, well, they're very beautiful. They have white, they're white from the knee down. That's how you can recognize them. Mm. And they're very tall. And, you know, we were together for about 10 days, and we saw about 800 of the giraffes. Mm. And the reason I got into this story was, this was in late 2015, earlier that year, I was in Rwanda, in Akagera Park with my family and my wife's sister and her little kids. And we came out onto this golden grass savanna in the late afternoon out of this acacia forest. And there, about 200 feet from us, was this very tall Maasai giraffe looking at us very curiously. And then the kids, my nieces, little nieces in the other safari truck, started screaming excitedly. And the giraffe somehow communicated to these nine other giraffes that were way maybe about 500 yards away that it was cool, nothing to worry about these people. And they came up in this kind of concerted, almost a slow-mo ballet, most beautiful, graceful moves, and came up until they were all circling us from about maybe 80 feet away, staring at us intently, but with no fear in their eyes. And they really wanted to sort of get down with us and have a little time together. And then the kids in the other truck got out of the car, which you don't do, and they started screaming excitedly, and the giraffes very carefully backed off just as gracefully and as they had done it, you know, as they had approached. So I'd seen a lot of giraffes. I've been going to Africa since 1983, but I'd never had that sort of moment of contact with them, which I have had with other animals. So I was very curious, and I looked into the literature, and the only thing comparable I could find was this woman, Anne Innes Dagg, who did the first field studies of giraffes or of any African wild animal in 1956 when she was 23. So she was studying, looking at these giraffes about half a mile away in the savannah down in South Africa. And she got out of her car and did some ballet stretches to exercise. And one of the giraffes was very intrigued and came right up to within 80 feet of her. Same thing. The others didn't. But in our case, all of them came. And they were young males, and they were very curious. And Anne, got back in the car because you're not supposed to influence the animal's behavior in every way. And she also said that actually I didn't have any categories in my list of giraffe behavior that I was studying for staring or curiosity. So particularly these young males are really curious. And I just found out something marvelous from my buddy here at the in Montreal at the CBC's The Receptionist.
Uh-huh.
He told me that in French Africa, the word girafe means to look over your shoulder when you're taking an exam and copy what the answers that the guy next to you are giving.
Yeah.
So that's a new one. So then I said, wow, I really want to. And then I found out how endangered, threatened they are. Their numbers have plummeted even worse than the elephants.
So give us the numbers. How dire is the situation?
Well, let's see. I think let's get this. I don't want to give you any bum numbers here, but it was in 19. Okay. Looking at the article here. 1998, there were an estimated 140,000 giraffes scattered throughout Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And now the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the IUCN, estimates, 97 plus.
So a dramatic decline.
Yes, more dramatic than the elephants.
Mm.
So I had written a story about elephants and ivory poaching for Vanity Fair in 2012, which went unexpectedly viral. None of us realized how many people out there love elephants.
And you did the same for giraffes.
Like,
yeah.
Well, if a billion people are watching this birth in New York State.
Right.
And I wonder if that's a Rothschild giraffe, because most of the ones in captivity are Rothschilds.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about magnificent giraffes and their plummeting populations. You can join the conversation. How much do you know about the beloved yet beguiling giraffe? What does it mean if yet another species goes extinct? In a BBC documentary that aired in October 2016, Julian Fennessy, executive director of the Giraffe Conservation Foundation, explains why people are so drawn to giraffes.
You have to love something so big and weird and sort of, out there. They're so funky looking. They don't make sense. They've got amazing eyelashes and, a lot of women love giraffe and their eyelashes. Everybody loves giraffe. I mean, they're a symbol for so many things around the world.
My guest today is Alex Shimatoff, a renowned nature writer who followed giraffes in Uganda for a Smithsonian Magazine piece called The Last Giraffe. And you can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. A lot of calls here. Let's get Roz in first in Cumberland City, Tennessee. Hi, Roz. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment. Years ago, we belonged to the zoo in Memphis, Tennessee. And one Christmas, as members, we were able to go in at night, and they had a nice tour, and we sang Christmas carols as we were going to the zoo. But when we got to the giraffe enclosure, they were all on the other side, and we had our candles, and we were singing Silent Night, and they turned and looked at us, and slowly, gracefully walked across the enclosure and stood and watched and listened, which was just amazing. Mm. And then a couple of years ago, I was fortunate enough to go to Kenya and have a safari and see them in the wild. And to be able to see such magnificent animals, and they had babies, it was that time of year, and the thought of they're becoming extinct. It's just heartbreaking because they are so magnificent.
Mm.
And the gentleman spoke earlier about the Rothschilds. Outside of Nairobi in Kenya, there is a refuge.
beautiful story, Roz. Thank you. They are graceful and stately, Alex Shumatov. You know, you've written about so many different animals from different corners of the world. You brought attention to endangered elephants. How dire is the situation with the giraffes? You talked about the population decline. Is poaching the biggest problem when we speak about this?
Well, poaching is big in rebel areas because, you know, one giraffe will feed a band of rebels for a couple of days. But the biggest thing is habitat loss, conversion of savanna and acacia forest to agriculture, road building. At Murchison, now they're going to be drilling for oil in the Murchison Falls National Park. So some habitat will be lost there.
Mm-hmm. And some of the people who live in these areas also kill and eat giraffe. A lot of them, the Tanzanians, I think here in your piece, you say the Tanzanians believe that eating giraffe brains and bone marrow will cure them of HIV. The San people believe giraffe blood possesses some vital essence that changes the weather. So there's a lot that goes into what happens to these animals on the ground.
Yes.
Let me bring in another voice here, Alex. Joining me from San Francisco via Skype is Derek Lee, principal scientist and founder of the Wild Nature Institute, a nonprofit that researches at-risk wildlife species. He's currently conducting the largest demographic study of giraffes in Africa. So great to have you, Derek. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Alex.
So there isn't a lot of research about giraffes. Alex has done some of it. You have, of course. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting because there was a flurry of activity, as Alex said, when Ann Dagg started this back in the 50s and 60s, but then it sort of died off. And I think a lot of attention was more focused on elephants and lions. There was the previous poaching crisis with elephants that I think got a lot of attention. And giraffes are just kind of a quietly standing in the distance, and while we weren't looking, they became endangered. And now the attention is much more focused on the giraffes once we've realized that they are in such trouble. Mm.
Tell us a little bit about giraffes. I remember interviewing the remarkable Jane Goodall about her work with chimpanzees and living with them and noting their incredible social networks. Giraffes are very different creatures, right? Their groups are not family-based. They move around a lot. They reform communities. Derek, tell us a little bit about their behavior.
Yeah, well, it is commonly thought that giraffes do not have much social structure, but the more we look into it, the more we're finding they actually do. They everything they do is so slow and deliberate and graceful, like the other people were saying. It takes a long time to see what's going on with giraffe society because they are so slow and graceful. But the more we look into it, we are seeing that there is social organization there and some very high-level behaviors. So I think that in the near future, we're going to see a lot of interesting science come out about giraffes and their behaviors and social structures.
How do they communicate?
They do a lot of visual communication with head gestures and shaking their manes, and they make some vocalizations like snorts. And there's been some recent discoveries that they actually make a sort of a creaking, humming sound at night to communicate with each other.
Here is that humming sound. Researchers at the University of Vienna took thousands of hours of recordings of European at European zoos of the giraffes and noticed that those humming noises were quite something. Here it is. You can hear that, but isn't some of the frequency with which they communicate too low for the human ear to detect, Derek?
Yeah, there is some evidence that they may do this infrasound communication. That's really hard to pinpoint, and we don't have a solid answer on that yet, but there is some evidence maybe they do that. It's similar to how elephants communicate across vast distances.
Mm. Let's get George in here from Miami, Florida. Hi, George. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I'm an African-American. I'm just returning to the U.S. After living in Africa for the last 37 years. And I've lived in Nigeria, Kenya, Tanzania, DR Congo, and Ghana over that period, mainly running American companies over there, but also in the DR Congo, I was running an NGO, an American NGO. And so that's it. I'm just, you know, recently returning. But again, over the course of this period, I originally went to Africa with USAID in 1971 as a student in a special program to get African Americans in the State Department. So I was out in southwest Tanzania in the Mikumi area, closer to the Ugandan border. So, of course, pretty much all of the Big Five were seen in that area.
Ah, beautiful. George, thank you for calling. Alex Shumatov, you spent 2 weeks with the giraffes in Uganda. Tell us about the landscape there and how the giraffes fit into that landscape.
Well, a lot of it is kind of open savanna, and there are places with various kinds of acacia, which
trees
near the water, acacia trees, which is what they eat. And the more they're closer to the water courses, the more acacias there are. And so they are, of course, eating acacia. That's what they eat. And there are many different kinds. And some of them are quite low, only reach up maybe to their shoulder height. And others they really crane to get to. And there are all kinds of other animals there. So what they're doing is, in the context of this whole pageant of all these different kinds of antelopes and buffaloes and leopards in the grass, lions, you know, it's a wonderful experience. I'd never spent so much time in the African savannah appreciating it.
That pageant sounds beautiful. Yeah. Derek, jump back in here. Giraffes, literally, they're quite literally above it all, right? The antelope and the leopards and the lions, they kind of glide above the rest.
Definitely. They're on a different plane from the rest of us.
And they wander in and out of herds seemingly unattached. Is that true?
Well, as I was mentioning, the social structure is something we're learning more about. There is some evidence that they do have these female-based social units similar to what you see with elephants, and composed of more related females and their offspring. And then when the males reach maturity, they leave the group and start to form bachelor herds and then roam around seeking females that are in estrus.
Let's get Shannon in here from Shelburne, Vermont. Hi, Shannon. Glad you called. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I was just thinking about an experience I had about 18 years ago when the scientist was talking about social structure. I was in the Serengeti, and we were out on safari at night, and we came across what I remember as being at least a dozen giraffes all in this more densely wooded area. And we wondered why they were there. And as we drove a few yards, we came across an elephant a giraffe that had passed and was lying on the ground. And they had all, from what we could tell, they had all come to pay tribute or to somehow be there. And it seemed like a funeral. And I remember just thinking that was so amazing and advanced. And so we talk about social structure, that really came to mind. And it's one of my most, I mean, to me, it was just beautiful.
Shannon, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Alex Shumatov, in your article in the Smithsonian, you write about the day that you came across an injured mother giraffe with a young calf. What happened?
Oh, well, that giraffe had been caught in a snare, which these Luo tribes people across the Albert Nile which describes the northern border of Murchison Falls Park, they come over at night and set these snares for antelopes. But sometimes giraffes get caught in them, and about 2% of the giraffes there have snare wounds. Mm. And this one was really gaping, and it was really, raw, and the giraffe could hardly walk. So we radioed to the vet of the park, and he came there, and after we left and darted the giraffe and then sewed him up and took care of him, and he's kept very busy in that park. That's the biggest threat in that area. They don't eat, the Luo don't eat giraffes because they believe that their saliva can give them leprosy. And that is thought to be because the older male giraffes turn sort of charcoal gray and sort of like, they don't even call people lepers anymore, people with Hansen's disease. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's the situation there.
Let's go to Joseph in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to call. Giraffes have a very important part in my life and my wife's life. I actually proposed to her at this place called Giraffe Ranch outside of Tampa. And I was able to do that in front of the giraffes while we were feeding them. And it was a special time for us. And even for our wedding, we got married at Brevard Zoo with the giraffes in the background. And, because there's so much of a part of our life and how we came together, it's a travesty that with dehabitation and poaching that we might be losing it. And, I just hope that we can find some type of resolve to, make sure this majestic creature just, can stay with us so that our children can be able to see them, not just in zoos like we were able to, but, one day, like some of your previous callers said, can even go to Africa and see them in the wild.
Joseph, thank you. Thank you very much for the call there from Tampa. Alex, or Derek Lee, talk to me about an experience you had that helped you understand giraffes better based on your research and your experience.
Was that for Alex?
It's for you, Derek.
Okay. I don't think anything can really compare to the first time you see a giraffe in the wild. They are like the Grand Canyon. Pictures can't convey the awesomeness of this creature. It's so huge and so majestic and so serene and beautiful that once you get close to them and see them in their natural habitat, it really just reaches into your heart and connects you to them.
We talked about the live cam birth at the beginning of the program, April the giraffe up in Harpersville, New York. How often do calves reproduce in the wild in captivity? Is there a difference, Derek Lee?
Well, giraffes tend to have a calf about every 20 months. They mature at about 4 or 5 years old. And then once they have their first calf, then they'll have a calf about every 20 months after that. They reproduce in any month of the year, which is an interesting thing that tropical animals can accomplish.
And Derek mentioned, Alex, the notion that female giraffes stick together after they give birth, right? And sort of raise their young together. Is that what you've experienced, Alex?
We did see, females who, with calves and afterwards, just older females together. I guess that could be, they're thinking this might be the social unit, like with elephants. I wanted to talk about the fact that, we don't know much about, hardly anything about the mental and emotional and moral lives of animals, of giraffes particularly. And I think there's just a lot more going on with them. This is a purely subjective anecdotal, non-scientific impression that I have, but they do have acute eyesight, acute sense of smell and hearing, and elephants don't have acute eyesight. They have fantastic memories, but I think these giraffes will prove to be much more intelligent than they've been given credit for.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting Blue Apron. .com/OP.
Hi, it's Tom. I'm glad you're listening to this On Point podcast. Really happy to have you here. You know, a lot of people barely know podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. Here at On Point, we want to change that. All this month, we're inviting our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. Do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Giraffes are in danger of extinction, and we're talking about that this hour with a top nature writer and giraffe expert about what we can do. You can join the conversation. How do you feel about one more disappearing African species? What do you think needs to be done? This hour with me, Alex Shumatov, a top environmental writer who wrote about the plight of giraffes for the Smithsonian Magazine piece called The Last Giraffe. And you can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also check out the magnificent images of the giraffes that he saw on that trip. Also with me this hour, Derek Lee, principal scientist and founder of the Wild Nature Institute, a nonprofit that researches at-risk wildlife species. Here's some sound just last year, September 2016, at Pilansberg Game Reserve in South Africa, where a mother giraffe growls as she tries to save her baby from being eaten by lions. Derek Lee, get between a mother and her young and a young one, and you'll hear it. You'll hear about it. Huffing and puffing and screaming and really...
Not the place to be.
Yeah, roaring like a lion. You tend to think of giraffes as being silent, but not always.
Right. They're generally very quiet and hard to disturb, but definitely will rise to the occasion when their babies are threatened. Mm.
Alex talked about the food that giraffes eat, and I wanted to bring up a bit from the article. Those acacia trees have a lot of thorns on them, and I was interesting to read that the giraffe's rubbery tongue and the thick saliva coats those thorns as they swallow them, Alex.
And they also eat ants, you know, that bite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can eat a lot of their and then these, I don't think the science is in completely about this. Maybe Derek knows how it is, but it's been proposed that some of these acacias emit a noxious odor to keep the giraffes from eating them. And then the giraffes doubled, and they can send signals to one tree to another. The giraffes are coming, emit this noxious chemical. And so then the giraffes kind of get around this by going upwind of the trees. What's the status of that investigation, Derek? Do you know?
Yeah, that story has been making the rounds for a long time, and I tried to find the source of it, and it was something that a guy mentioned in South Africa, and he never did the follow-up work, so we're still waiting to see how true that is. Trees do communicate chemically, and when a tree is browsed, some of those chemicals get out into the air and could be picked up by other trees. And then they can start to produce these tannins and things that animals don't like to eat. And like you mentioned, the ants, that's a really cool story too, about these ants that certain species of acacia trees make homes and feed the ants to live in the branches, so that when a giraffe or other animals come to browse, the ants come out and bite and annoy the animal, so it will move on and browse a different tree.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, those I saw on the lower kinds of acacia, it merges and falls.
Right, Japanilobium or whistling thorn.
Symbiosis, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Let's get Liz in here from Northampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Liz. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for this great program.
Thank you.
My question is, what's the best way for people concerned about these beautiful animals to support conservation efforts? Thanks.
Liz, thank you. Derek Lee, what do you say?
Well, I mean, since the announcement that giraffes are vulnerable to extinction, a lot of people have wondered what they can do. And, I mean, the obvious simple thing most people can do is give money or time to a conservation group. And a great thing that most people can do is also just communicate this, because awareness of the problem is the first step. So many people don't realize that giraffes are endangered. And so if people can just communicate this within their social circles and encourage their friends and colleagues to donate time or money, anyone who has any skills can find a way to help giraffes, because the conservation world is generally underfunded and understaffed, and anybody who wants to help is welcome.
Derek Lee, talk about the different regions in Africa and how they're affected, because I think I read that 7 countries in Africa, there are no longer giraffes.
That's right. They've been extirpated in at least 7 countries: Burkina Faso, Eritrea, Guinea, Mali, Mauritania, Nigeria, and Senegal. And in West Africa particularly, there's been vast loss of range as that subspecies has gone down to only a few hundred individuals.
Mm. Let's get
in Niger, right?
That's where the remaining population.
And what does it mean for the African ecosystem then, Derek, if these giraffes become extinct?
Oh, well, it would be terrible. Like that example I was talking about, the ants and the giraffes, these ants that live in the trees, there was a beautiful, elegant experiment where they put fences up to simulate what happens if a giraffes went extinct. And by excluding the giraffes, those trees stopped feeding those defensive ants, and those ants left, and a different species came in, which attracted wood-boring beetles, and the woodlands were actually damaged by the loss of giraffes and browsing. So one might have thought that having animals browsing on the trees and removing them would help the trees, but in fact, because of all the interconnections of everything in the ecosystem, those trees were damaged by removing the giraffes. The Earth is like a spaceship traveling through space, and if we lose species, it's like popping random rivets or smashing random components of our spaceship, and eventually we're going to be in trouble.
Alex Shumatov, how do you see the African ecosystem changing if these giraffes go away?
Well, I haven't been able to see that over time, but I've seen places where elephants have been eliminated, and it's not been good for the ecosystem at all. They keep things, a lot of things, under control with their grazing, and I expect that giraffes do too. Mm.
Let's get Herbie in here from Sarasota, Florida. Hi, Herbie, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a personal giraffe story. We were in Botswana about 6 years ago, and we were in the middle of a clearing, and we were observing a herd of giraffes. There were probably 30 of them, and all of a sudden, they start stampeding toward our Jeep vehicle. They, of course, ran around us, but we're talking about running probably 10 or 15 feet from our vehicle. Their hooves are making the ground shake. There's dust flying, and we noticed they were being chased by a lion. And I can't imagine, I mean, it was both one of the most exciting things I've ever experienced, and I can't imagine giraffes going away and not being able to experience that wonderful event. So,
what a picture. Herbie, thank you very much for sharing that. Let's go to Jerry in Miami, Florida. Hi, Jerry, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have more of a comment.
Okay.
Not a question. I wanted to share, I'm half Kenyan. My father's from Kenya, and I recently went to Kenya in June. And, of course, they have giraffes in the safaris, and they have giraffe parks where they have them just focus on the giraffes. But also, when we leave the capital of Nairobi, we were going to Nakuru, which is a smaller town.
Mm-hmm.
And on the roads, on the road trip, you see them walking in the field, just walking. They're not enclosed, and it's hard for me to hear that they're dying out, because I don't know what Kenya's doing differently, but there are plenty just walking, you know, in the road when you're going to the different towns. They're beautiful. They look happy. I don't know what is it that Kenya is doing different. Maybe, I don't know.
Let's ask Jerry. Thank you. Derek Lee, would you respond to that?
Yeah, that is a common understanding, is that if there's any giraffes around at all, they're obvious because they're so huge and striking. And so the giraffes can be declining at the same time as they seem common when you drive around and you notice the few that are around. The giraffes in Kenya have declined drastically, as they have across most of Africa. The only growing populations are the ones that have been in the ones in the West Africa that went from like 50 individuals up to a few hundred, and in South Africa where they're ranched like similar to cattle in game ranches. And the Rothschilds, which is also recovering from a near extinction event of only, you know, being down to extremely low numbers. But in Kenya, Tanzania, they seem abundant, but they have been declining drastically over the past few decades. Like in Tanzania, we've lost more than 50% in the last few decades, and Kenya is not far behind that.
Derek Lee, talk about tracking giraffes. I was interested to learn that that giraffes' spot patterns are like fingerprints. Is that used? Is a spot pattern used to track a giraffe?
It is. It's a wonderful way of keeping track of individuals, because every giraffe is born with unique spot patterns that don't change over their life, just like a fingerprint. And we can use that as an identifier. So we're tracking more than 2,100 giraffes around the Tarangire ecosystem in Tanzania. And it's an amazing tool, because normally in wildlife biology, we have to catch the animal and put some kind of a number on them, or a leg band or an ear tag. But these giraffes are all born with a natural mark. So we know every single individual in our study area. And it's an amazing tool for studying births and deaths and movements, and figure out why a population is increasing or decreasing.
And then, the left side patterns are different from the right side.
Oh, is that right, Alex?
Yeah. Yeah, the sides are different. So we just use the right side when we're identifying animals, just to make it simpler.
Here's Vanessa in Key West, Florida. Hi, Vanessa. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Jane. What a fantastic program.
Oh, thank you.
The giraffe is my favorite animal of all time.
Wonderful.
I grew up in Kenya, East Africa, and my very, very dear friends of our family were Betty and Jock Leslie Melville, who started a conservancy called A Few, African Fund for Endangered Wildlife. And they were the first people to notice that the Rothschild, which has been mentioned by Derek, was becoming really endangered. And so they started a sanctuary for them just outside of Nairobi at a lovely place called Giraffe Manor. And you can go there and learn about the giraffe life cycle and all of that. So I just wanted to mention that people are doing the best they can, but the spaceship analogy was pretty interesting. We really don't want to lose these magnificent creatures.
Agreed. Vanessa, thank you very much for the call there from Key West. Derek Lee, until recently, taxonomists considered all giraffes to be part of a single species, but it turns out there are four separate species of giraffes, right? They're as genetically distinct from one another as the brown bear is from the polar bear. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, as long as Western European scientists have known about giraffes, there's been an evolving understanding of taxonomy. And there's actually about a half dozen different taxonomic schemes for dividing up giraffes. At the moment, the IUCN and the giraffe scientists have all agreed that we're going to stick with the one species system with nine subspecies until we can do a little bit more work and hammer out a consensus agreement on how many species there are. But there's definitely genetic variation within the giraffe world.
Because if you list them separately on endangered lists, then don't they receive more special attention?
Well, There was two of the subspecies were listed as threatened several years ago, and that was maybe part of the initial impetus to draw more attention to giraffes because, and raise awareness that they're becoming endangered with these two incredibly endangered subspecies, which were down into minuscule numbers, the West African and the Rothschilds. And the, and so that was definitely the start of it. But there is not complete agreement on how many species there should be. There's probably more than one species, but for the time being, we're sticking with the one species plan just for simplicity.
They're all
vulnerable to extinction.
Let's get Amir in here from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Amir. You're on the program. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I had a question. I was curious to know, what are some things that either we can do or that can be done to make, you know, such magnificent creatures more feasible to protect, being that, you know, they are such desirable creatures and, you know, from poaching, things like that, loss of humanity. So what are things that can be done to protect them?
Right. I'm reading in this piece, Amir, thank you for the call. Alex, Congolese poachers gun down giraffes for their tails, which they use for marriage dowries. In Kenya, Al-Shabaab militants issue recruitment videos inviting would-be jihadists to come kill a giraffe. There's a lot of poaching going on. Not much time left. Alex, what would you say?
About the amount of poaching?
About the poaching and what you can do to stop it.
Well, they're doing, I know that the Uganda Conservation Foundation is doing a lot of work in Murchison to stop these guys who come across the river at night and set the snares. I think that Derek's outfit is supporting a lot of anti-poaching. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it just, that's what has to be done, and I hope they will. There's another question we haven't brought up, is the skin disease. Can you tell, Derek, what that's in your area, Tanzania.
About 30 seconds, Derek. What would you say about that?
We found this giraffe skin disease is not a serious threat. It doesn't have a big mortality effect. Poaching and habitat loss are really the major problems in our area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So about 30 seconds here, Derek, what would you leave us with? Give us a thought about the beautiful, amazing, and vanishing giraffe.
Well, I just hope that people can spread the word and raise awareness. There's four elephants for every one giraffe in Africa right now, but the plight of elephants is much better known. We need to raise the awareness of giraffe conservation issues.
Well, I hope this program has done a little bit to do that. Derek Lee, Principal Scientist at the Wild Nature Institute, thank you so much for being with us today and for your work on the ground. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Alex Shumatov, writer of the great Smithsonian piece, The Last Giraffe. Beautiful images and terrific work. Thank you, Alex.
Oh, thank you.
Continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.